And our special guest this hour, Brian Fry. We're talking about his work, Venom Doc. It's an incredible story. He is a venomologist. That's right. He extracts venom from poisonous snakes. He's been bitten 26 times. You've heard some of the stories. We've got more to come, plus your calls, questions, your own stories. Have you been bitten by an animal? Share that with us when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Brian Fry with me, Venom Doc. Hey, we're going to get to your calls. I've got a few more questions that I want to ask Brian, and then we'll get to your calls. Brian, you have had all kinds of things happen to you in this career. I mean, all kinds. Has your body now become, or has it built up an immunity to bites, or does it do that?
Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. So and it's of course not just the snake bite side of things, but the physical trauma that can occur, where I've broken 24 bones, including my back, in three places the first time I broke it.
Oh my god.
Over 400 stitches. Even my scars have scars.
How did you break your back?
First time I was at the top of a 4-meter termite mound and it crumbled, sending me flying through the air, and I had enough time to think this is going to hurt. And it did. I landed on another termite mound about a meter off the ground and broke L4, L5, and S1. Spent 4 months in the hospital. They had to rebuild my spine using cobalt metal alloy. So my x-ray and those three vertebrae look like Wolverine. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then I've got artificial discs in between them. So, rebuilding me one piece at a time.
Now, you met your wife in a very unique way. Why don't you tell us about that?
So she saw one of my nature documentaries and thought, I was interesting. So we got to chatting. She asked if I was going to be in Europe. She was living in Geneva at the time. And turned out that I was going to be in Europe about 2 months later. So we met up, and our first date was 3 weeks across Siberia, including going to Lake Baikal, which holds 20% of the world's fresh water. It's the largest lake in the world. And it's a pretty amazing ecosystem. And we fell in love on that trip. And then our next date was going out to play with Komodo dragons over in Indonesia.
Wow. Which
is a very strange romance. But, we're both very strange people, so it suits our style quite well.
How does she feel about you dealing with these venomous snakes? Can she handle that now?
Of course she's concerned, something might happen to her Zaya, and, it's something that when we're out and we're working with a snake, she looks at that snake with absolute hatred, because, how dare you potentially hurt my hubby?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, sounds like she's a fighter like you are, Brian.
Oh, she is. Very much so.
That's great. I love those kind of stories. They're fantastic. Well, the book is called Venom Doc, and we're going to get you your calls in just a second. They're lining up here to talk with you about all kinds of things, including probably people getting... I got bitten by a dog when I was a kid, and then for years, I was afraid of dogs. For years after that.
Yeah.
And then
absolutely.
I grew out of it, and now I love them. I own them and everything else. But, man, I remember walking home from school. And in those days, Brian, for boots, little kids would have these rubber galoshes that had a little piece of metal around the top, and you had like five or six different ones, and that's how you bolted down the boots on your feet. But you couldn't really run with these things. They were always bigger than your shoes, and they were galoshes because that's what they did. They galoshed along. But I'm walking down the sidewalk, and this dog comes flying at me, small dog, but man, just yipping and yapping, and I start running, and I'm running with these boots on, and I'm not going much, and he gets me right around the calf and just bites me, and I'm screaming, and the owners came and pulled the dog off, and of course, no rabies, thank God, no shots for me, and the dog was clean, but man, it took years before I really got close to dogs again. I mean, it was horrendous. I can imagine what it's like to get bitten by a snake. I got stung a couple months ago when I was back in St. Louis. I'm in the St. Louis now again for the holidays. I got stung by a bunch of yellow jackets, and that's an experience I don't want to repeat. That was horrible. So getting bitten by insects or creatures and reptiles, that's not fun, Brian.
No, it's not the fun part of the job at all. You know, it's you know, an acceptable risk, you know, in some respects.
What has been the scariest place you've been doing what you do?
It'd be a toss-up between Colombia and Pakistan. In Colombia, we were in the mountains inside, in from Santa Marta, so up in La Victoria in the mountains there. And where we were in a coffee plantation looking for South American coral snakes. We were chatting with the owner when we got there, and it turned out that the week before, that FARC had invaded the coffee plantation, lined up all the workers, asked whose mobile number, you know, a particular number was. One guy just kind of shrugged and said, mine, and then they shot him and killed him right in front of everybody.
Oh, my God.
It turned out he had been ringing his girlfriend, who lived a few mountain ranges away, in an area held by another insurgent group, and the FARC rebels had been monitoring calls from, you know, going in and out of their region, and they thought somebody was informing on their movements to a competing group, when in fact he was just ringing his girlfriend. And as we were leaving, coming down the mountain, the same people surrounded our vehicle and were going to kidnap us, but then we showed them the bags full of venomous snakes that we had, which they thought was actually pretty cool, and let us go. So that was an interesting experience. And then in Pakistan, while we were there, we started getting very interesting graffiti on our building of a flag with a sword going through it and some squiggles off to the side. No idea what the squiggle said, but you know, I had a very good idea of what the sword going through a flag was supposed to mean. And 3 days after we left, our safe house was blown up.
Oh, my God. Unbelievable. You know, the story I had before you came on about a Burmese python that swallowed three deer. How in the heck do they do that? How do they fit the legs down their throats?
Well, keep in mind, we're talking small deer. We're not talking massive things like
right.
deer or even a big whitetail.
These were little ones.
Florida native deer, which are kind of bulk-sized. You know, they're not a big animal. And as they swallow, the legs just fold up along the side of the body.
My God. And then how long does it take to digest an animal like that?
With pythons, when they take very large meals like that, it can take them a considerable period of time, of weeks or even a month or two, to fully digest if it's a very large prey. And the animal, the python itself, is quite vulnerable at this point because they're not obviously as agile or able to move the way they normally would. So after a very large meal, they want to go curl up in like a big tree stump or a hollow or a cave and be protected from that while they digest this very large meal.
The biggest snake out there now is what, an anaconda?
Well, for a simple length, yes. The longest is the reticulated python in Southeast Asia, which can get up to 10 meters, about 30 feet.
Wow.
They're not as heavy as an anaconda, so an 18-foot anaconda is actually going to weigh considerably more than a reticulated python, and that's because reticulated pythons live on land, while the anacondas live in the water, so therefore that massive body is supported by the water itself, so they can become more massive without putting incredible pressure on their ribs and therefore their lungs.
Would either one of those snakes swallow a human being?
Yeah, these are the only two, and perhaps the, you know, African rock python, where they can actually swallow a person, and even then you're talking about a small Asian child, because the width of the shoulders is really the right limiting step. Where, you know, that with your average, you know, adult, you know, they're even an adult Asian is going to be too big for them to swallow. But, you know, so it has to be something that they can get their mouth around the shoulders. Now, this is not to say that they can't kill someone larger. One of my mates was killed here in Australia by a 17-foot scrub python, one that he was keeping in captivity. They got a hold of him when he was alone, and it wrapped around him and suffocated him.
Oh,
but it didn't try to eat him. It was just purely a, you know, defensive reaction by this, you know, very sort of testy snake.
What does that do? It just squeezes you to death, literally, where you just can't breathe?
Yeah, and also at the same point, it's jacking up your blood pressure. So people, or even prey animals, are actually not so much dying from suffocation. They're actually dying more from extreme blood pressure.
Ah, all right, that's interesting. Now, would a snake like this ever eat a human while the human was alive? So
No,
it's like
because
it's
they might
gulping
be.
the gulping down a human being that's still alive. No.
No, so none of the snakes swallow their prey while it's still alive. They need to subjugate, immobilize their prey, either through chemical means like a venom or mechanical means such as constriction. But they wait until the prey is dead because otherwise the prey could fight back while they're trying to swallow it.
Right. Who wins the fight between a crocodile and a python, for example?
Well, it'll depend on the relative size of the two. The anacondas or Australian water pythons, both of those will regularly predate on smallish crocodilians, but something like a 23-foot Australian saltwater crocodile would be able to eat any snake that it came across.
Does a snake stalk its prey?
Yeah, they do. So some snakes are very active foragers, such as the Australian taipans that are active during the daytime and are seeking out and are using their vision to spot and then pursue. Other snakes are ambush feeders where they wait for a prey animal to come by. They'll sniff, they'll find a game trail where prey are regularly passing by. They'll take up position, wait hours, days, or even weeks before something comes by in the right proximity, and then they're basically the venomous equivalent of a landmine.
Okay, let's take some calls now for you. Let's start by going to Mark on our wild card line. Try driving somewhere in Iowa. Mark, go ahead.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
This past summer, I found like four or five copperheads in my yard. I know they got that snake away, and I've heard mothballs, but I was wondering if there was something good that would keep them away that wouldn't hurt the kids or the dog or the cat.
Very good question. First off, they probably weren't cottonmouths. They're probably actually harmless water snakes that look very, very similar, particularly to the juvenile pattern of the cottonmouth. But anyway, that aside, you have two major factors. One is the right sort of structure where the snakes can hide, and then the other one is prey. So, of course, keeping the lawn short, not having boards down or having old sofas or old cars around your structure that provide habitat is an excellent way to reduce the friendliness of the habitat to the snakes. And then the other part is, of course, prey availability. That, for example, in Australia, people who keep chickens often have a lot of snakes around because chickens are very messy feeders. That attracts a lot of mice, which then in turn attracts predators. None of the chemical or electrical snake deterrents actually work. So mothballs or sulfur or these electric, snake away little posts that people put in their yard, they don't actually do anything, unfortunately. So that aspect isn't going to, be in your favor. All you can do is, keep things, tidy and make it unfriendly. Now, in case of, with your snakes, clearly you must have some sort of water nearby on your property.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. He's just
Well, in the
listening.
sense of like, that you have a pond or a creek, and then you just have to be snake aware that no, of course, there's nothing you can do about that, but just, wear tall boots if you're walking around that area, and have a little bit of personal protection, in that kind of regard.
How come some snakes aren't poisonous, like a little garter snake, for example?
Well, actually, technically they are. They're
Oh,
just not
really?
medically important. Yeah, just like every spider is venomous, the vast majority of snakes out there are actually venomous, but people confuse venomous with of being medical and medically important. So things like garter snakes have a low pressure venom delivery system, very small amounts of venom, and it's also evolutionarily selected to be very potent against amphibians, not mammals, let alone humans. So the human danger side of it is less than that of a bee, but they use their venom to help immobilize the frogs that they swallow on. It says they're not of any medical importance to us, but it doesn't mean from a biological perspective that they're not venomous, which means that they're another potential source for research into life-saving medications that could have vast economic impact. So from a practical perspective, they're non-venomous from, the consideration of medical importance. I can't stress that enough. But from a technical evolutionary biology perspective, they actually are venomous. But, I don't want people to go out and treat them like they are a venomous snake, like a rattlesnake would be. These are chalk and cheese by comparison.
Next up, Jefferson City, Missouri. Paul's with us. Hi, Paul. Good morning, and you're on with us.
Hi, George. I'm a relatively new listener. I just watched the show.
Thank you for joining us.
Kind of fortuitous that you have this expert on. Yeah, I'm in a unique situation. I'm a seriously targeted individual. I mean, my family and I are being exterminated. And I wondered, is venom ever used by people in a malicious manner? Because one of the things that we go through is being drugged and assaulted. And I woke up and
my
joints were very sore and progressively sore. And then I found injection points on each of the joints, deep injections. And my muscles became eviscerated over the day.
All right, let's find out. Can venom be used like that, Brian? As some kind of small weapon?
Yeah, so if you look, for example, throughout history, the first use of biological warfare was actually involving snakes, where the Greeks would have clay pots and they would launch snakes from one boat to another, and of course pandemonium would ensue. Now, in this particular case, I would view it as highly unlikely because outside of special laboratory storage conditions, the venom is quite unstable. So it's not the kind of thing that would be readily usable for any kind of biological weapon. You know, it does have to be injected. It's not something that, you know, you can be absorbed by touch or ingestion. But, you know, I would say that in this case, you know, it would be highly unlikely to be involving any sort of venom.
Okay, well, that's a good thing. Paul, good luck to you. Paul, let me go back to you for just a second. Why have they singled you and your family out? What do you think's going on?
I don't know. If you want to call me sometime, I mean, it's very, very, very serious situation.
All right. I'm going to put you on. We'll put you on hold. Tom, you give Tom your phone number. Tom, take care of that for me, if you would. And I obviously can't write it down, but Tom can back in L.A. Well, we'll give you a call, and I'm very curious to see why they have singled you out there. Indeed. How many venom docs like you, Brian, are out there?
It's a vast spectrum. So most of the people who work on venoms purchase the venom. They don't actually go out and collect it themselves. So there's a lot of people working on venoms, but there's very few people collecting the venoms because that's the dangerous part of it. My laboratory is a bit unusual in that we catch the majority of the animals that we work on. And of course, that's the dangerous part of it. And I've had 6 friends and colleagues get killed by snakes.
Oh, that's sad.
Over the years.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back. Final segment to go. Final phone calls before we go into open lines later tonight with Brian Fry, his book, Venom Doc. It's a fascinating book, folks. It really is, about all these things that happen with snakes. I mean, what a job. I mean, I'm glad I'm doing what I'm doing. I don't want to extract venom from a snake. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Open lines next hour, and we're going to come back and take final calls with Brian Fry, Venom Doc. And welcome back. Fascinating subject, Venom Doc. Brian Fry with us. He's been bitten by snakes, by scorpions, all kinds of things. But what are your favorite animals out there, Brian?
Well, snakes, of course, as well as my dogs. I'm generally an animal nut, but as far as my favorite snakes, easily king cobras. They have an unusual level of intelligence that you don't normally associate with a reptile. Them and Komodo dragons are both unusually smart, which fits with the fact that they're very large, long-lived predators.
With these kinds of animals that are out there, I mean, and there's all kinds that you have looked at, with snakes, of course, being the favorite. How do you feel about the devil being called the serpent? Does that bother you?
Well, it fits with the whole idea of the demonizing, where if you look at, you know, the whole idea of any religion is simply to use myths to reinforce a code of behavior that often has very practical elements. Like, for example, the Muslim prohibition against eating pork is grounded in an element of reality, where Trichinella spiralis, the parasite that is endemic to pigs in that region, is actually lethal to humans. So if you were in times of antiquity, you ate a pig, you would die. So therefore, we need to get people to not do this. So let's have amiss, unclean souls or whatever it may be, and therefore that reinforces this code of behavior of not eating pork. Not sure where the Jewish one about not eating fish on Friday, maybe because they didn't have refrigeration and they did more of their fishing earlier in the week and it was rotten by then, who knows. But as far as like the idea of where if you have your, antithesis to your benevolent, side you want to be on, you often make it look very ugly and hideous. That's why the depiction of, God and Jesus are, these beautiful creatures, although the Americans have this particularly weird one of Jesus looking like a blue-eyed surfer with a six-pack, not the little Palestinian that he may have actually been. But, by the same point, you have to demonize the other side of it. So therefore, with things like the devil, it fits where you would give it like a snake tail because people are already afraid of snakes. And sometimes in their real-world situations where, people do get killed by these animals. So it's combining a real-world concern to link up with a nightmare to therefore make it even more something that you're supposed to be afraid of, and therefore don't do whatever it is the prohibition is.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Scott in San Luis Obispo in California. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George. Hello, Brian.
Hi there.
Yeah, hi. I was a few days ago, I just happened to be reading on this topic online. It was about about this island off the coast of Brazil called Snake Island. It's an uninhabited island, which has been warned by the Brazilian Navy for people not to travel there because it's infested with snakes, such as the golden lancehead snake, which is responsible for about 20% of snake-bitten fatalities in Brazil. I'm not sure why this island has become so snake-infested, but I guess my question is, have you ever been there, or would you consider going there for research, or is it just too dangerous?
Now, I have been there, and it's quite a remarkable island. And there is a very high density of snakes there, and the reason for that is that they're the top of the food chain. The island's too small to support large predators like jungle cats or anything like that. So they're the top predator on the island, and the island is a stop-off point for migratory birds. So there's a steady, large food supply coming through. Now, what makes these snakes even more interesting is that unlike the mainland equivalents that they evolved from, where they evolved in this island, there used to be a land bridge that connected it to the mainland, rising sea levels trapped the snakes on that island, they've evolved into a new species, but because they're the top of their local food chain and therefore have no natural predators, they're actually much calmer than the mainland equivalents, which are, pretty bitey snakes that will bite much more readily than the lancehead. So that was the first thing that really struck me about the golden lance-headed vipers is that they're an unusually calm snake, which is good because they're hard to see. They're a yellowy color because they're spending a lot of time up in the trees, and so they're the kind of yellow that would fit in perfectly with the yellow of a dead leaf. So they're perfectly camouflaged for sitting there amongst the shrubs and low trees and waiting for a small bird to come by so they can drill it.
I remember one of the Indiana Jones movies, Brian, where there was a huge snake pit. I mean, all kinds of things. And he said, I hate snakes. But what has been for you, or where have you been? Have you ever seen a mound of snakes slithering all over the place?
No, because, of course, those kinds of situations only exist in the feverish imagination of Hollywood. Or if you look carefully at that footage, for the first Indiana Jones movie that you're talking about, classic iconic scene, but if you look in there, there's actually a fair few legless lizards mixed in.
Right.
So they have it's just a big pile of snakes in a Hollywood studio lot. And, things don't occur to that density. Well, I wish they would. It'd be a lot of fun. But, it's another example of the depiction of, Hollywood of preying on these very primordial fears. And this is why people are so scared of snakes. It's a learned fear. It's a conditioning.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
A young child has no fear of snakes. When we do educational talks, the kids, the younger the kids, they're just right up to the front. But by the time they're hitting 10 or 12 years of age, they're in the back and they're genuinely scared. And when we have a calm conversation with them afterwards, more often than not, this is the first time they've actually seen a snake in real life. So they haven't had any particular traumatic event in their past. Rather, it's just societal conditioning to fear snakes in particular, but nature in general. And this is part of a larger conservation issue, because we have removed ourselves from nature, and therefore nature is now something to either be conquered and vanquished or to be afraid of, and therefore demonized and defeated. And this has really come through with the, if you look at the change in literature pre- and post-industrial revolution and the tone and tenor that people take in association with nature. Pre-industrial revolution, nature is actually something that people are living more in harmony with and symbiotically, but post-industrial revolution and the now concentration of the populace into high-density cities, people are now removed from it, and therefore it becomes the fear of the unknown. You know, our own imagination is always much more feverish than the actual, sometimes very benign reality that exists.
Brian, do snakes make noises, sounds, not like a rattlesnake or anything like that, but I mean, do they literally make sounds out of their mouth?
Yeah, they do, in the sense that with some of them, it's just a simple hiss, which is just deflating their lungs very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The air is now rushing through a small opening, their nostrils or the trachea opening inside their mouth. And that gives that characteristic hiss that we associate with snakes. It's the same sort of sound as if you took a tire inner tube and put a puncture in it, you'd hear that sort of rushing of the wind, and it would sound like a snake's hiss. Other snakes can do actually much more complex vocalizations, such as king cobras, which can do a sort of an almost like a growly sort of noise, and that's very unique for those snakes.
Let's go to Jim in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, Jim, go for it.
Hey, George. I get the opportunity tonight to do a little payback on you.
Uh-huh.
You've given me the heebie-jeebies many a night listening to your show. So tonight I'm going to be able to tell you a story that probably
okay.
Do the same to you.
This is it. Go for
okay.
it.
I grew up out in western Nebraska in a little town called Ogallala. And I was schooled by my parents about rattlesnakes from early age. And interestingly, as your guest was just saying, little kids don't have much fear of snakes.
No, they don't.
I remember walking across the street from my neighbor's driveway, which had a bunch of rock landscaping around it, and I had about a 9 or 10 inch long snake draped over the end of a foot long piece of pipe I was holding. And my mom realized it was a baby rattler and just freaked out.
Oh.
Next door neighbor, and he came over and disposed of them in a very similar manner to what the Marines used on the Pacific Islands. They basically turned over the rock and doused them with gas and torched the whole nest, but there was a bunch of them in there.
That is the heebie-jeebies.
No, you're getting worse than that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So, okay, I was like maybe 8 or 9 years old when that happened. Fast forward up to when I was about 11.
All right.
We go out, my mom, my dad, and I, cruising out onto the prairie on a beautiful, warm day, and we're going to hunt a rattlesnake. And sure enough, here's one laid out there catching him some rays. And I took a .410 shotgun and shot it, blew its head off.
Yikes.
Took it home, nailed it up on a tree. My mom, who was a very refined lady, I mean, she was not a plains woman or whatever, you know, kind of thing. But she, honestly, got grabbed onto the edge of the skin up where the head had been removed. Pulled the skin all the way down to the rattle, which had like 7 rattles and a button on it, which would mean it was an 8-year-old snake.
Mm-hmm.
And then disemboweled it and cleaned it, took it in the house, cut it into pieces about 3 to 4 inches long each, floured it up and put it in a frying pan, and each piece was still twitching and moving around in the frying pan. And then we ate it. And it was good, man.
They say it tastes like chicken.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I was just going to say that people always say weird stuff like that. They're like, oh, it tastes like chicken. Well, it did. And it was good.
Brian, have you ever eaten a snake?
No, I haven't actually. I've eaten whale, I've eaten seal, I've eaten a lot of weird things, but I haven't eaten snake.
Hey, Jim, thanks for sharing those stories. I like those. I guess if people have to protect themselves, they have to kill the snake. But that does that bother you?
Well, yes, no, maybe, in the sense that what people are perceiving as a danger often really isn't. You know, first off, it may not even be a venomous snake. Secondly, the snake is not going to actively come over to the person. So if they have enough time to go in and get a shotgun, they're not at any, you know, immediate danger. You know, they would be better off calling Parks and Wildlife and having someone trained come over to remove the animal safely for both the snake and also people involved.
Of course,
even if they don't like snakes, they can cause tremendous damage trying to do it themselves. There was one case, of course, involving Florida woman, you know, the spouse of Florida man. I'm convinced that there's only two people in Florida and they're having an entertaining life. But in this case, she saw a snake, she poured petrol down, tried to kill the snake, and just instead burned her house down.
Oh. What causes the rattle sound in a rattlesnake?
So they have a structure at the end of their tail where every time they shed, a new bit of this is added on, and it's made out of the same material as our fingernail, which is also the same material that's made out of a rhino's horn, which goes to show that people who want to use rhino horn instead of just Viagra are idiots. I believe that's another topic for another day. But it's used as a warning device. So the rattlesnake wants nothing to do with us. They're trying to warn us off because they don't want to fight. Even if they're going to win, they could still get injured and die afterwards. Could be the ultimate hollow victory. So they're just rattling it to deter potential predators, much like how a cobra hoods up to deter potential predators. So they're just trying to say, hey, leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. Much like, you know, the original U.S. flag, you know, back in the colony days of Don't Tread on Me, which featured a timber rattlesnake, which I would think, you know, would have made a very, you know, excellent national animal.
Kathy is with us in Alaska now. Hi, Kath. Go ahead.
Hi. I've lived in Fujian province in China, where there's lots of poisonous snakes. And I've had many encounters with cobras, bamboo viper, and vipers. I have a friend who catches pit vipers. And he says, oh, they like to be touched. That's why it's so easy to catch them. Is there any truth to that? And one other question. The farmers told me that at night, you know, after it rains, there's tons of snakes all over the road. And they said, oh, when you go outside, you know, use your stick and bang the road and you'll be safe. Without a flashlight, I don't know. Is that is there truth to that?
Well, worms come out when it rains. I guess snakes would too, Brian, huh?
Yeah. So in regards to the first part of it, no snake wants to be touched. You know, they don't deserve, you know, get any pleasure out of this. You know, so going out and fondling a snake is not going to make it easier to catch it. So it's rather that those particular types of snakes are quite calm. So they're not biting due to their benevolence rather than anything that the person is doing per se. Now, as far as snakes coming out with rain, definitely, because that's when the prey is coming out. There's lots of frogs out for them to eat. Now, as far as banging with the stick, that's actually very sensible advice because the snakes will detect the vibrations, and they're more likely to just slide off long before you get there because that kind of vibration will be transmitted very efficiently through the dense earth, and that can be detected meters or tens of meters away, depending on obviously how hard you're banging. That, you know, then the snake can just glide off, and because it's thinking that a heavy-bodied animal, a potential predator, is on the approach, and so they're going to go hide.
Brian, can a snake be trained to do anything?
Tragically, no. Snakes are remarkably stupid animals. Even in King Cobra, the Einstein of the snake world is not exactly the cleverest creature in the world. You know, brain-dead village idiot is still smart.
So you can't go walk your snake.
They can't be trained to do tricks, which is, you know, unfortunate, because otherwise, you know, you could have all kinds of entertaining things involving pythons and tricks. But so, no, they can't. You know, they can be conditioned to not react and to fear with you, but that's about the extent of it.
Richard in London, Ontario, Canada. Go ahead, Richard. We'll get you in real fast.
Okay. Hi, George.
Hi Brian. There.
In Windsor, in 1991, my girlfriend Diane and I, we had a little cabin cruiser. I got bitten by a spider, but there was a lot of snakes there too. But this was a water spider, and I saw black dots in front of my eyes.
Oh, man.
But I didn't get medical attention. I wanted to get to Babel Island for the weekend.
Been there many times in my day.
And I tell you, though, there was a lot of snakes, like around Island View Marina and Duck Island. And my dad told me a story about Belle Isle. At one time was infested with snakes.
That's what I had heard.
And they put pigs, because the pig has a hard skin. They couldn't penetrate through the pig, and the pigs ate all the snakes.
Huh.
Then they built Belle Isle. Do you remember that? Because I know you're from Michigan.
I remember the snake story. I don't remember the pig story, but let's ask Brian. Brian, do pigs eat snakes?
Yeah, pigs are omnivores, and they're incredibly destructive when they're introduced as a feral species, such in cases like this. So all that did was do a radical shifting of the island ecology. You're removing a vital part of the ecosystem web, which can have unintended consequences in other parts of, you know, the island ecology. So it's obviously an incredibly short-sighted thing, particularly since in that region, almost certainly just about everything that the people were seeing were harmless water snakes.
Richard, your website, want to give it out? Brian? Thank you, Richard.
Sorry, what was that?
Brian, your website, you want to give it out for us?
Oh, so my website is venomdoc.com, venomdoc.com.
Simple as that. And the name of the book, of course, is called Venom Doc. Great read. Brian, thank you so much. Scary, but I loved it.
No, thank you for having me on. You know, I like the idea of any show that's intellectually curious.
You got it. Up next, Open Lines on Coast to Coast.